This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Jill Stein, MD, a member of the steering committee of the Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility and co-founder of the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities. She was an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School from 1982 to 2005 and co-authored the report In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development. Jill Stein is here today to tell us about the report, Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging, with a closer look at Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, co-authored with Ted Shetler, Ben Rohrer, and Maria Valenti, and published by the Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility and the Science and Environmental Health Network. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane. Good to be here.
What led you to write your report, Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging?
The report is actually an outgrowth of the report you mentioned that was written 8 years prior. That report was a discussion of environmental factors in childhood disability. And at that time, it was clear that the science had a very compelling message. That is that environmental factors are major drivers and contributors to ADD and learning disabilities and autism and so on, and that these drivers can be avoided. And the science was really very much in need of broader public discussion. So we set out at that time to draw greater public attention to this wonderful opportunity of prevention, really. And then 8 years later, we realized that there was growing information that the disabilities at the other end of life might also be avoided. So we basically set out to examine that data and to translate it for broader public discussion.
What are the normal changes in the brain with aging, and how do these differ from disease states?
Well, that's a very good question. And the prevailing wisdom out there is that you're well or you get a neurodegenerative disease. But in fact, the science really clarifies that there's a broad spectrum of changes with aging. Some people's brains don't age really at all. Most people's brains age somewhat, that is, have a decline in both cell number as well as cell function. And then there are other people that clearly have impairments which may be devastating. And while the prevailing wisdom is that there are these little pockets, and we call them Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body disease or Parkinson's disease, in fact, there's a great deal of overlap and continuity, both among diseases themselves and between the state of normal function, decline with aging, and then disease itself. So the lines are not nearly as clearly drawn as the old labels would have us believe. And in that, there's actually a message of great hope, which is that these diseases are not God-given. They don't come with us when we're born. In fact, there is enormous interplay here between the environment and our biology that in turn creates lots of opportunities for prevention in order to maintain good brain function and good brain structure throughout life.
What is known about the cause of degenerative diseases of the brain that seem to come with aging, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease?
Well, this is really what we set out to discuss in the report, because it's clear that an awful lot of the discussion, at least up until recently, has all focused on genetics, when in fact, genetics play an extremely small role in the vast, vast majority of disease. It's really only a couple of percent of the cases of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's where genes play a strong role. Most of the time, they play a very, very small role and do so largely through interactions with the environment. So we really wanted to sort of set the record straight and look at what else does the science say, what else does the science point to. And it's clear that it points to any number of things. When we began the report, we were looking predominantly at toxicants because that had been the focus of our report looking at early life. So we were asking the question, what do toxicants have to do with brain degeneration? And There are some toxicants for which the case is very, very strong, such that we can really begin to talk about causality. For example, the links between pesticide exposure and Parkinson's disease are very well established now. So pesticides are a clear driver of Parkinson's. Lead has emerged as not only a driver of disability in childhood, but also as a driver of disability later in life. And for example, one study in particular looked at men in the community in later life and looked at their cognitive decline or their cognitive health, and basically found that if you stratified people by their exposure to lead, lead was extremely important in determining how well people could remember and could process information, such that in a normal population comparing low to high exposures, you had an aging of roughly 15 years of brain function. Comparing people of the same age, if you were on the higher end of lead exposure throughout life, that is cumulative lead exposure, your brain was on average 15 years more aged than someone who wasn't lead exposure. So those are two examples. Air pollution is another one, surprisingly, and this is more recent data that compared the brains of people who were in highly air-polluted cities versus the brains of people in clean-air cities. And these were post-mortem exams, that is, after death, in people who had died from car accidents or, say, from cancer. Disease is not related to brain degeneration, and of all ages, including many teenagers. And what these studies found was that in the polluted air cities, you had markers, even very early in life, and brain changes, and the inflammation typical of Alzheimer's disease, and also the markers associated with Parkinson's disease at early stages in life. So this is another red flag that air pollution is a player here, too. What we were very surprised to find was the very strong case in the scientific literature that nutrition is a huge contributor, and in particular what we call novel nutrients, that is, new dietary patterns associated with the global industrial diet, the corporatized diet. That nutrient pattern is highly associated with brain inflammation and greater risk for Alzheimer's disease in particular. So nutrition also turned out to be very important. Likewise, physical activity and stress. That sort of generally covers the broad waterfront, but there are many environmental factors that are strongly associated with risks, and cutting back, intervening in those factors can markedly reduce the risks for Alzheimer's disease.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Dr. Jill Stein of the Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility and co-author of the report, Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you comment on the so-called Western disease cluster and the relation to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease?
Yes. And there, in fact, Diane, you're touching on another really important driver, which I didn't mention, of neurodegeneration, and that is other disease states, particularly in this Western disease cluster. When we started the report, we were just going to write about the brain, but we discovered that one of the major drivers of brain decline is actually other diseases, particularly earlier in life, especially around midlife. So the Western disease cluster refers to a group of diseases which, in fact, cluster together in the West. The name means exactly sort of what it says. And these diseases include cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, elevated blood lipids, and a thing called the metabolic syndrome, which some of your listeners may have heard of. Many people out there actually have it. In fact, 40% of all adults over age 60 have metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is essentially a touch of all the other diseases. It's early stages of diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and elevated blood lipids that defines metabolic syndrome. And what we find is that these diseases, the group of them, tend to cluster together. They come together in cultures so that when a developing nation, say in Africa or Asia, begins to develop one of these diseases, they generally begin to develop them all. They tend to come together cross-culturally. They come together in individuals. If you have one of them, you're at risk for getting the others. And they also cluster together within that one disease, metabolic syndrome. So that's the entity, and it's kind of like the elephant in the room. We talk about all kinds of other conditions, and we sort of subdivide this and talk about its different compartments, but the reality is it tends to come together, and it is having a devastating impact. Let me just jump for a minute to the numbers. We know, for example, that two-thirds of adults in the U.S. are either overweight or obese, and those numbers have roughly tripled in the last three decades. One out of every three adults either has diabetes or pre-diabetes, that is, elevated blood sugar without the full-blown symptoms of diabetes. Cardiovascular disease is our biggest killer. It has been on the decline. Let's hope it stays there, but all the risk factors for it are going up. And metabolic syndrome, as I said before, you know, is 40% of all adults over 60. So this is the elephant in the room. This has enormous public health impact on our quality of life, on the cost to our healthcare system, and so on. And it's seriously on the rise in a big way. So it's really important for us to come to terms with it. And the well-kept secret about these diseases is that we don't need to have them. They are not God-given. We're not supposed to have them. And in fact, you don't see them epidemiologically. You don't see them looking around the world except where you begin to get Westernization. And then they come on with a vengeance. However, we also know that by doing the right things, you can essentially get rid of them. We know that these diseases are somewhere between 80 to 95% preventable from scientific studies themselves. So the significance of the Western disease cluster is that this is a big problem, and there's no excuse for it, essentially. You know, we're sort of told to take our medications, which are expensive and often toxic, and go home, when in fact, you know, there should be enormous outrage about these diseases, the fact that they are being environmentally driven, and that we as individuals and as communities can be empowered to essentially eliminate them.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but why do you call the Western disease cluster diseases of civilization in your report? Would you say more about that?
There are specific factors in the way that we live in Westernized society that are driving these diseases, and we know that from a whole variety of evidence, including that when Western civilization sets in, you get these diseases. But we've been able to parcel out what is it about Western society that's driving these diseases. Diet, we know, is one big player here. As societies move to the industrialized, globalized diet, they begin to get a number of these problems. And we know that some of the drivers here are, you know, all the things that we see wrong with our diet today: lack of fruits and vegetables, loss of micronutrients, loss of omega-3 fatty acids, the kinds of fatty acids that are generally called anti-inflammatory, although it's a little more complicated than that, but they're very important for full function of the immune system and regulation of it. Our diet, you know, tends to be high in saturated fat, very high in what we call glycemic index. We're eating loads of refined carbohydrates rather than whole grains, so that the glucose, when we eat our crackers or our chips, let alone drink our high fructose soft drinks, you know, our blood sugar skyrockets. And that's a major driver of diabetes and the complications associated with it, including cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. So the globalized food system is a major driver. Inadequate exercise and the built environment go together. We tend to be confined by roadways as well as by cars. Kids can't just go out and play the way they used to. They can't walk to school, or very rarely at least. It requires sort of special conditions to be able to do that. Few communities have the luxury of environments where kids can safely walk to school. You know, the lack of exercise is a major contributor. The use of fossil fuel creates pervasive conditions of air pollution, which we now know to be a driver of not only asthma and lung diseases, but also heart disease, which is part of this Western disease cluster. And we now know that air pollution from fossil fuels is also a contributor to brain inflammation as well, which drives towards Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. those are some of the major factors that are driving various aspects of this Western disease cluster.
Would you touch now just very briefly on the cellular mechanisms and pathways that appear to underlie this Western disease cluster, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, these mechanisms are really important because they kind of bring method to this madness. Before I learned about this stuff, which was in the course of, you know, researching this report over the last 4 years, before I knew about these mechanisms, it just seemed odd. Why are all these things lining up? Why are all the things that we consider bad for the environment also bad not only for our hearts? You know, they're bad for our lungs. They're bad for diabetes. Why is this? Is this just coincidence or what? Well, it turns out it's not coincidence. There are actually these underlying biological mechanisms or pathways that link these diseases together, and they also link these environmental actors with these diseases. They sort of provide a broad integrating framework. And there are three key pathways or mechanisms, but they in themselves are extremely interconnected and interrelated and overlapping. So the three mechanisms are inflammation, oxidative stress, and insulin signaling. And that may sound like, you know, just a bunch of Greek, but let me explain each of those just a little bit. Inflammation is basically the activation of the immune system. And inflammation is active when we have an infection or when we have trauma. Inflammation is part of fighting off the invader. It's also part of tissue healing. So inflammation is a normal thing. Examples of inflammation, just to help you visualize it, someone who has a very sore infected joint, for example, or a very sore rheumatoid arthritis joint, the joint gets red, it gets hot, it gets inflamed, it gets painful. This is inflammation which has been described since the time of the Romans with those hallmarks, those basic characteristics, heat, redness, swelling, and pain. That's basically inflammation, and that's pretty much how we've always thought of it. But in the last decade or so, we've learned that inflammation can take place when we can't see it, when it's not visible. Asthma, for example, is inflammation in the lungs. You can't see it, but there you see all this. You see this purulent, pussy sputum that people cough up, so you know that there's inflammation there. Even more subtle is the inflammation in a heart attack. You wouldn't know that there's inflammation going on, but in fact we now know that inflammation in the blood vessels is actually the disease underlying heart disease and heart attacks. Likewise for strokes and brain disease, it's inflammation in the blood vessels in the brain. So that inflammation is a major driver that we've come to understand in the last decade or two of really all these diseases in the Western disease cluster. And we now understand that the globalized, industrialized diet is full of stuff that's highly inflammatory. Lack of exercise is inflammatory. Air pollution is inflammatory. Stress, economic disparities, psychological stress as well can be drivers of inflammation. So inflammation is one broad integrating mechanism that takes these environmental factors and translates them into effects on the body that drive towards these Western disease clusters, including Alzheimer's disease. The second mechanism is oxidative stress. I won't say a whole lot about that except to say that we use oxygen to burn things that we're eating. In the same way that you need oxygen to light a fire, our bodies need oxygen to burn the sugars and the fats that we use to generate energy. And when we burn this fuel, we generate what are called reactive oxygen species, or ROS for short. And we always have some level of these reactive oxygen species. They're a part of normal physiology. That's why we need antioxidants, which we generally get from our food. Our antioxidants allow us to constantly put out the fire that these reactive oxygen species or oxygen stress causes. And again, oxidative stress goes hand in hand with inflammation. Inflammation causes oxidative stress and vice versa. You don't have to understand the details of it to know that it's one of the players here. And the same factors that I was describing that cause inflammation also cause oxidative stress. So it, too, is a broad integrating factor. And, for example, many of the chemicals that we know to be bad actors, like most pesticides, solvents, air pollution, act to cause oxidative stress. And I might add several endocrine disruptors as well, we know also cause oxidative stress. The third mechanism is disrupted insulin signaling. Insulin, you may know, is the hormone that makes our energy systems work. You need insulin in order to digest glucose or sugar, for example. When we eat sugar or carbohydrate food, you need insulin, which comes from your pancreas. Diabetics are people who don't have adequate levels of insulin, or their insulin isn't working properly. They have what's called insulin resistance. And insulin allows you to be healthy. In the absence of insulin, you get elevated blood sugar, and you get the other symptoms of diabetes, including high levels of fat in your blood and problems with blood vessel function and eventually blood vessel disease. So insulin signaling is also very closely connected with inflammation and oxidative stress. That's really kind of one of the major points in our report, and it's a linkage that is out there in the medical literature, but it tends to get lost in the shuffle. And it's a really critical linkage because it explains so much of what we're observing. And in a nutshell, what it is this: when you get inflammation and oxidative stress from chemical exposures, from industrial globalized diet, from living in confinement surrounded by roads and you can't go out and walk around or take a walk in the woods, you get inflammation and oxidative stress. That disrupts your insulin signaling. That's the bottom line right there, is that when you get inflammation going, it throws a monkey wrench into the wheels of insulin signaling, insulin processing, so that insulin can't do the things it usually does, and you get a state of what's called insulin resistance, and then you get the other downstream consequences of inadequate insulin, or, to put it another way, low-grade or subclinical diabetes. The consequences of that are, you know, basically elevated blood lipids, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, and increased risks for Alzheimer's disease. So I know that's a mouthful, but the critical point is that you have these three biological mechanisms, and they bring together a mountain of observed science and suddenly begin to explain it in a way that makes sense. One of the ways I describe this, it's like way back when we used to think that the universe, you know, the stars and the heavens had all these crazy patterns. It was called the Ptolemaic universe. So the Ptolemaic universe was full of all these little patterns superimposed on patterns, and you had to learn a whole book of patterns to understand what was happening when and why. And then Copernicus came along, and then Galileo, and they said, well, actually, this all makes sense if you get that we are a planet revolving around the sun, and that's why things are changing, you know. But if you put the sun in the middle of the galaxy, suddenly you understand why these things are the way they are. It totally simplified this very complicated understanding of the universe. And to get that inflammation and oxidative stress disrupt insulin signaling sort of begins to fold together all this complicated information out there, and suddenly it begins to make a whole lot of sense. And you've got these environmental drivers which are working through these mechanisms that cause these diseases that we really don't need to have.
Which public policy steps would be most helpful to prevent these diseases?
There are a bunch of them. And the good thing is that when we prevent these diseases, we're also preventing other critical environmental problems. And I'm just going to focus on one of them for the moment, and that's climate change, the incredible climate crisis that we're facing now. So, for example, by returning to a more localized food system, more localized, sustainable, and organic food system, all of a sudden, you have all the makings of healthy food. You have fresh and accessible fruits and vegetables, which begin to give you your micronutrients, and they're close by, so they don't have to be shipped. They don't have to be picked early for shipping, so they've got better micronutrients and the antioxidants and so on. So you have improved nutrition on that account. When we move away from the confined animal feeding, all sorts of health benefits come into play. In confined animal feeding, not only do you have the pesticides, you know, in the food, and you have the requirement for antibiotics because the animals aren't supposed to be that close together, but you also have a complete change in the nutrients in that food. So you have higher levels of omega-6 fatty acids. You have less saturated fat. The fatty acid profile changes when the animals are eating green things rather than grain, which is what they're supposed to be eating, and when they're able to be walking around. They don't do well when they're couch potatoes in the same way that humans don't do well when we're couch potatoes. So when you have organic pasture-fed animal products, both dairy or meat, and the same goes for chicken, that food is much healthier for you. Now, just to jump to the climate impacts, we know that about 18% of greenhouse gases are coming from our globalized food system, and loads of it is coming from the confined animal feeding operations, where the animals are producing methane because, A, they're eating grain, which they shouldn't be eating, and because their sewage is anaerobically rotting, shall we say, in a way that it shouldn't be allowed to happen. And this is a major, major source of greenhouse gases. So in moving to local sustainable food production, you not only create lots of jobs, you create a stable economy that can't disappear when the stock market crashes or when the CEOs decide to file for bankruptcy. You create a stable economy and you create a healthy environment at the same time that you greatly improve health. So there's one example, a very powerful one, in your globalized food system. Same could be said for moving away from fossil fuel energy, moving to renewables and conservation. You know, we can drastically reduce our fossil fuel use. Thereby, you not only reduce your greenhouse gases, you also reduce drivers of air pollution and fossil fuel toxics. And then briefly on transportation, there's no excuse for us not to have a cost-effective, energy-efficient public transportation that dovetails with sidewalks and bike paths. We could be walking and exercising and greatly reducing our use of the automobile with all the benefits that that brings in public transit systems that would be enormously beneficial to our health at the same time that we could be drastically reducing greenhouse gases. So there are three big policy changes that both improve our health at the same time that they safeguard the climate.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That this is really in our hands, that we can raise the bar in our communities, in our places of work, in our homes, in our schools, in state and national government, that it's really important for us to move policy both for our health as well as for the environment and the economy. There's a win-win-win here. There's everything to gain here in terms of retrieving, revitalizing our health and our environmental future and our economies as well. And there's lots of information available on our website, and feel free to get in touch with us at Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're working with other chapters, including the Seattle chapter, which has a wonderful Physicians for Social Responsibility chapter as well. We'll be working to help get this information out at the community level and at the healthcare provider level in order to support change from the grassroots on up.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much, Diane. Really appreciate it.
We have just been speaking with Dr. Jill Stein of the Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility and co-author with Ted Shetler, Ben Rohr, and Maria Valenti of the report Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging, with a closer look at Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, published in 2008 by the Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility and the Science and Environmental Health Network. For more information, check on the web at www.psr.org/Boston, where you can download a copy of the Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging report. Again, that's psr.org/Boston. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM. NKEXP.org.